Worry a lot about worker productivity. They tell us productive workforce, that's the key, yet they don't seem to worry about global warming at the same time. Or are they missing something?
Absolutely. And this is the focus of a good deal of the work that I'm doing at the moment. That's actually looking to see what is the human thermal tolerance. I mean, obviously I'm Australian and my work is focused on Australia at the moment, but it's part of a global project. But at the moment, what we find is that the places in the southern part of the continent, they actually think are hot days around about, you know, 25, 27 degrees. They can keep working, but they feel it hot. At the top end of Australia, where it's in the tropical region, we've got Darwin that's sort of 32, 33 degrees. It used to be 32, 33 every day. Well, now it's sort of 35 every day. But the humidity is extreme. And every time when we go and visit those places, the plane opens and we just get knocked by this wall of sort of oppressive heat and humidity, and we find it very difficult to move. A lot of people move up to Darwin and you know, the other tropical areas around Australia, as they would do to the hot areas in other places. Those that can't cope with it pack up and go home back to a cooler place. And we find a lot of, you know, if people are sent to work, if their families can't cope, they move back. What's really becoming alarming is that a lot of these areas are going to become even more intensively hot, and that's going to probably make even a smaller proportion of the population be able to cope. And, of course, all these places involve, you know, people that work in construction, people that climb up your telephone poles to fix those when we're in the power blackout, the people that change your car tyres, the district nurses who go out and visit people. And, of course, in the heat waves in Australia, you could imagine the district nurses are really not very inclined to call in sick saying, oh, no, look, it's too hot, because they know that if they don't go out and visit the people in their care, they're going to die. And so the people that sort of push themselves beyond their thermal tolerance tend to fall into a few categories. There are those with the awful employers that force them. Hopefully in a civil society, we don't have ugly, horrible employers much anymore, but of course some will still exist. Or people that are in fear of losing their jobs. It's also people that feel responsible. You know, they're responsible, like the essential services, the police, the ambulance, the district nurses, the SES who come and save you or fix your telephone poles, or the military, of course, have been another category. In fact, a lot of the early work on heat tolerance actually came out of the military, as they were finding that the soldiers were dying in training, and it was pretty difficult for the military to send letters home to their mothers saying, look, sorry, your son died, he didn't see combat, we just pushed him too hard. And so there is an upper thermal tolerance. We don't actually know what that is. There has been virtually no work done on this as far as the general working population around Australia, you know, in the world. And that's what my project's actually trying to do, and find out what strategies work, what don't work, because we're certainly going to have to change our way of thinking. Because the bottom line is that when you've got a hot place like Australia, and this is the same for all those Asian countries, the economy cannot tolerate us thinking, okay, well, it's summer, we have to down tools and industry just to shut up shop. Conversely, we can't keep pushing people until they die. And, of course, a lot of those jobs just can't be done in air-conditioned comfort. But, we really need to sort out how we're going to cope with this. And the bottom line is that if the planet keeps warming, it's going to be a real problem.
It's going to affect our whole economy.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Liz Hanna from Australian National University. She is a specialist in how the human body handles extreme heat. And as you point out, there have been studies done for the military and also for athletes, how they're going to cope, say, in the Summer Olympics. But it seems like we haven't done much about the miners, the farmers, or the people who keep our whole system going. What does need to be done?
I think we need a new mindset. There are certain tasks that we can leave till the cooler part of the day and do in, you know, the cooler times of the year. But there are certain tasks that really do need to be done. In some industries, that might mean having cool rooms where people can actually go out, do their job and come in and cool down. Because certainly, I mean, even in Australia, some jobs are done at night. As it is, a lot of the road making in summer is done at night. Picking the grapes is done at night, although I'm told that that's actually largely because it's better for the grapes rather than for the people. It's a sad reflection. I understand that in countries such as yours where you have blizzards and snow, that there's tolerance when there are blizzards and snow and people can't move. Even in places like Australia, there isn't. We don't have formalised tolerances for houses taking too long to be built or people not coming into work in those jobs that have some flexibility because of the heat. We're not taught in the health curricula about heat because it seemed to be such a rare thing and it just wasn't on the radar. And of course now it's something that we're just going to have to educate ourselves and actually permeate it through, you know, through society, making people being aware of looking out for each other, looking out for their children, looking out for their elderly, and being tolerant on each other in terms of the workplace and expectations.
Well, Dr. Hannah, I'm assuming some industries and companies will be too slow to make the necessary changes. And will we see more occupational injuries and death due to a hotter climate, I would expect? And if so, what would that look like?
Sadly, yes, that probably is true because it's, in an ideal world, all industries, all companies and everyone would behave perfectly. Although sadly, we realise this isn't always the case. There are some positive movements that we're seeing in Australia now, but of course, interestingly, they're the ones that are signing into being participants in my project. They're the ones that actually recognise that heat is an issue. Those that say, oh, no, not interested, they're the ones that we really do need to get to, but of course, you can't participate in people who won't engage with you, and you wonder what their work practices are.
What does it look like at the medical level when these things happen?
There's a few things. At the light level, dehydration is a really, really key part of it because of the extra strain it puts on the body. When people get to a certain level of dehydration, and it's really at the very early stages, your cognitive function starts to diminish. This becomes really problematic if people are in charge of heavy equipment or making decisions. And this is only when you're, you know, only a few percent, very small percent of dehydration. There's other risks such as even just sweaty hands and people's, you know, slipping and dropping things. And so the occupational health and safety is an issue in that respect. And that can come at even sort of the early stages. In the hot places such as one of our tropical towns, Darwin, 80% of the violence happens during certain months of the year, which is called the build-up, and that's when it gets really hot and the humidity starts to kick in. And this is the male-to-male violence and the domestic violence. That's huge. It's because it becomes very oppressive. So there's mental health issues as well in terms of, you know, violence and irritation, aggression. And physiologically, it's interesting the pathway that happens. It's, if you're fully acclimatized, obviously what our body tries to do is to kick in the thermoregulatory system, and that's when it's hot, it's largely through perspiration. So we start sweating a lot. Sweating adds to the dehydration. And the other thing is when it's hot, we try to shed heat by opening up all the skin blood vessels, which means that the volume of your blood vessels opens up a lot. So A, you're losing fluid by sweating. B, it's opening up the vessels, and if you increase the volume of the circulatory system, the pressure goes down, which means you really do need to drink to fill up that volume. If you're not drinking enough, that means that your heart is working really, really hard to keep perfusing that. And if you're working or exercising or doing things, it's also trying to send a lot of blood through your muscles. At the same time, it's trying to dissipate heat by sending a lot of blood to the skin. And so it's working, that's what, it goes very, very hard and it works very fast and very strong beats. And that's why the people that have compromised cardiac performance, they're the ones that are likely to suffer early. And of course, just in heat waves, even if people aren't actually working, it's one of the reasons why you find the elderly who are the first to succumb. But of course, that can happen to anyone who's pushing themselves too hard. And people tend not to recognise it. In a place like Australia, some of the responses we're getting from people we interview is that, look, it's just summer, get over it. You know, don't be wussy. You know, you can keep going, just, you know, soldier on. And I think this is where we need to change our mindset in the fact that recognise that heat can kill and is killing people. In fact, it's already killing more people than the road death. And heat has killed more people in Australia than any other natural hazard ever. And this is repeated annually. And this is even prior to the increased deaths that we're having with all these extra fires and, you know, these extreme heat waves. Because, I mean, we got up to, you know, a city in Melbourne, you know, 4 million people. On the outskirts of Melbourne was just under 50 degrees, and that's 50. A city can't cope with temperatures like that. The train lines buckled, so we had to stop the trains and put people out on buses and walking in extreme heat. It's just not tenable.
Our guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Hanna, an expert in global heating and human health at the Australian National University. Thank you so much, Dr. Hanna.
Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Journalists love to worry what will happen if heat devastates food production in one of the three so-called breadbasket countries, the ones that feed millions around the world because they have enough to export. We know because it has already happened in spectacular fashion in Russia in 2010. In my archives, I have various quotes from top Russian politicians promising global warming would be good for the country. More heat would expand the growing area in Siberia, for example. Everyone wants shorter winters. Then reality called. The Russian heat wave was a multi-factor catastrophe. A study by a team of University of Oxford experts estimated at least 55,000 people died during it. Here again, we likely have a cause of natural variability. It might have been hot, but it was totally pumped up by climate change. That heat wave was poorly reported in the Western press. It was a new level of heat, and reports from the Russian government were sporadic. I followed a couple of dozen sources and pieced it together. Then I phoned Vladimir Chuparov of Greenpeace Russia. He was living through the heat wave in Moscow. Here are a couple of short clips from our radio interview.
This is a serious abnormality. The Russian Weather Service has never measured such temperatures in Moscow in July. According to our calculations, it hasn't even reached its peak yet.
The Arctic ice again retreated to near record low levels. In the United States, new heat records were set in many states. In fact, 17 different countries set all-time heat records this past summer, from Latin America through Africa and the Middle East to Russia itself. In Pakistan, floods beyond imagination created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. But the harbinger, the messenger from the future, took the Russian people into uncharted hell. Moscow, at the latitude of Alaska, boiled in the weather of Cairo, while grasping smoky air equivalent to two packs a day of cigarettes for every man, woman, and child. Russian leaders who bragged global warming would be good for that northern country got a taste of the coming century. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The heat, drought, and fires in Russia during the summer of 2010 were truly shocking. To make sense of this, we're joined by Vladimir Chuparov. Vladimir, were you in Moscow during the heat wave, and can you describe your personal experience of these events?
This is Vladimir Chuparov. Yes, all this summer I spent in Moscow. And 2 weeks was most difficult, as it was a smog, around-the-clock smog in Moscow. Just to explain you, it was smelling with fire, so with temperature plus 40 degrees Celsius, which is absolutely untypical for Moscow, which is 20 degrees above the typical temperature this time. The visibility in the street, this distance of visibility was about 200 meters. People walking in the street with masks, not all of them, but a lot. And in a few hours of walking the street with masks, the mask is becoming brown. The air was full of carbon monoxide, which caused a lot of deaths. And the death rate in Moscow decreased twice. So it was quite horrible. So people waiting all the time. So it was impossible to open windows around the clock, especially in the night, as then the smoke get to the flat, to inside. So it was very extreme, especially for children and the people having disease, blood and lung disease. So all the people had shock, as it was quite untypical, and people were not ready for such extreme conditions, weather conditions. And psychologically, it was very frustrating as people understood they can do nothing in this situation because the power, the Ministry of Emergency Situation, who was in charge for firefight in this pit box near Moscow, they could do nothing. And it was a situation when the human being could not control the nature processes, which was very unusual and typical, and it showed that sometimes that the humankind, it coming to end, so it cannot control anything in this planet. So psychologically, it shaked Russian public, Russian society.
Well, thank you so much, Vladimir. And I want to say, reporting from Moscow, our guest has been Vladimir Chuprov. He's the head of the energy unit at Greenpeace Russia. Right, and Moscow is located at 56 degrees north. That's a similar latitude to the Alaskan Panhandle or Glasgow in Scotland. And so a warm, sunny day should be about 75 degrees there, not over 100 degrees or 38 Celsius as it was day after day. Whether or not the Russian firestorm was directly caused by climate change, it is a hard lesson on what we can expect from the future. Here are just a few of the issues stirred up by the heat, the smoke, and the drought, and the fires. Learn what you will from these 15 warnings.
Number 1.
Fatalities from heat and smog caused the death rate to double in Moscow. Large cities can be attacked by climate change to become deadly traps.
2.
An estimated 2,000 Russians drowned trying to escape the heat. Some died in drinking fountains. Some drank too much alcohol, trying to cope with the heat and stress.
3.
The fires revealed the extreme and nearly uncontrollable dangers posed by climate change to nuclear facilities, both power reactors and military bases. Think upon that.
Number 4.
Many people tried to leave the big city, Moscow, but were prevented by smoke-closed roads and airports. Subways became dangerous. Traffic accidents and fatalities went way up. Essential goods, including food and medical supplies, couldn't get through. Transportation systems break down.
5.
The number of homeless people grew as villages were burned out.
6.
Peat fires went up to 12 feet underground and are expected to burn until winter.
7.
Crops die. 1/5 of the Russian grains were lost, exports banned, and international wheat prices rose. In the future, grain importers like the North African nations may starve. Let's take a few minutes from our countdown to listen to this press conference with Lester Brown. He's the founder of World Watch and founder of Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. I recorded his web conference for journalists in August. Lester Brown has been tracking the world's grain supplies for decades.
Another thing that I've learned, at least from this experience, is how lucky we have been that this heat wave was in Moscow and not in Chicago or Beijing. I say that because Russia produces at most 100 million tons of wheat. Even if it loses 40% of the harvest, which it's close to doing now, it would be a loss of 40 million tons in the world grain harvest. But if Chicago were to have a July with average temperatures 14 degrees above the norm, the U.S. could lose half of its grain harvest. The U.S. harvests about 400 million tons of grain a year. 300 million of that is corn, most of it grown in the Midwest. Chicago is at the heart of the U.S. Corn Belt. 50% of 400 million tons would be 200 million tons. But even 150 or 100 million tons would be an enormous setback for a world where carryover stocks are right on the edge of what we consider to be secure. Or we could look at Beijing. Beijing is near the heart of the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn. China, like the U.S., produces 400 million tons of grain per year. A heat wave in the North China Plain could easily cut that harvest by 100 million tons, maybe by 150 or more. What I draw from this is that we have to take global warming far more seriously than we are now doing as a society. If this teaches us anything, it is that we need to cut carbon emissions and cut them fast. We need to cut them fast before climate change spirals out of control. Because if we reach that point, then intense heat waves, such as the one that's taken over Moscow, and indeed much of Western Russia, over the last 7 weeks, could be occurring more frequently and in more dangerous places in terms of world food security. I've mentioned Chicago and Beijing. I could mention other places. But to anyone who's prepared to think about it, this heat wave centered around Moscow has to be a wake-up call for the world. And we need to do something about climate change and do it quickly.
That was Lester Brown, author of Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. That's a good idea. Find out a lot more at earthpolicy.org. Now we continue with lessons for the future from the grim heat wave and firestorm in Russia during the summer of 2010.
Number 8.
Home gardens, community gardens, and survival gardens died. Beyond certain limits, plants cannot cope with a hotter climate and drought. Survivalists should begin testing their varieties and their strategies for cooling plants and watering them, or consider relocating to a microclimate regulated by the ocean or other large bodies of water.
Number 9.
Mobile conditioners sold out within 3 weeks, just as the heat set in. Many Moscow-based companies failed to foresee this heat, and they didn't want to fill their warehouses because of the crisis.
In a situation where no amount of money can buy you a gulp of fresh air, emergency centers are receiving thousands of calls from people suffering from heat stroke and sunburn.
People with lung diseases will find it hard, of course, so it'd be better to take them somewhere where there's no smoke. Another option would be to buy them a respiratory mask. They sell them in pharmacies.
Natalia Noikova, RT, Moscow.
Fans, air conditioners, and inflatable pools sold out very quickly. Money could not buy a cool place or fresh air. Air conditioners may be useless if the power goes out. Consider your tools.
10.
Some wealthy Russians were able to get out, including government officials. With the poor stuck and dying, class stress or even violence is possible during extreme climate events. Think New Orleans under Hurricane Katrina.
11.
The electric grid is strained and power lines burned down, including those coming from nuclear power stations. Brownouts and blackouts are likely in the future, even in countries like Great Britain or America.
Number 12.
People suffer extreme psychological stress. Will your baby, grandma, or asthmatic husband be okay? Are you afraid to go out for work or supplies? Will crime and violence flare in the day-after-day relentless heat? Do people come to fear the weather? What are the long-term mental health risks?
Of when the fire started, and it was literally just a wall of fire as tall as the trees. It was terrifying, and they said that it all happened in almost a matter of seconds. There was almost literally nothing people could do. The fire spread from the trees to the houses, burning them down in seconds. People losing everything that they've been accumulating for their entire lives. Now they don't know what to do, how to start over again. And this, of course, is just one of the villages in Russia where such a terrible thing has happened all across the country, with the fires ravaging central Russia for over a month. Thousands of people have been left homeless.
13.
Even more carbon was released into the atmosphere. Global warming will feed more global warming. The Russian fires released millions of tons of carbon from the forests into the sky. The black particles swirled up into the international Arctic, darkening snow, hastening more melting. Brown clouds traveled as far as Beijing.
14.
The economic costs continue to mount for Russia. Forest jobs lost, workers don't show up, expensive firefighting and restoration costs, roads wiped out, crops wiped out, including orchards, farm equipment, and buildings. In Russia, the loss is estimated at least 1% of the GDP.
And number 15.
Public anger mounts, and big government often fails to handle anything with competence. Regime change, as we may yet see in Pakistan after the floods, is always possible after major climate hits. The long-term impact on public confidence is unknown. Governments may swing to authoritarian forms or break down into smaller states or even anarchy. The only way to control our path toward the future, to limit the horror of these trends, is to control our carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases. The alternative, as Climate Progress blogger Joe Rome says, is hell and high water. After studying this 2010 heat disaster intensively, I published 15 short things to learn from it. These are the takeaways. And every one of them applies to extreme heat and wildfires bubbling up all over the world during the last year and right now in many parts of the world, including, of course, California. Well, it's time to say goodbye to somebody. There is a saying in science that no one is convinced of a new paradigm. As the famous German physicist Max Planck said, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. So it is with climate change. Here is American Senator and Chief Climate Denier James Inhofe back in 2010.
I don't think that anyone disagrees with the fact that we actually are in the middle of a cold period that started about 9 years ago.
James Inhofe died July 9, 2024, during extreme heat across the American West, including his home state of Oklahoma. His claim that Earth was cooling has been proven wrong, dead wrong. The original climate deniers and fossil fuel profiteers will all die away, leaving generations to suffer in heat, storms, fires, and a dying natural world. Every child will grow up in a destabilized climate. They will know. You can get an electronic book with my best of Radio EcoShock interviews all transcribed on heat just by sending me an email. I will send back a PDF format ebook for free. I don't keep a mailing list of listener names. There are no catches or sales angles. Use the subject line free book, and I will send you Surviving the New Age of Extreme Heat. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Feel free to email me anytime with your experiences, what's going on in your world, and ideas for the show. I always like to hear from listeners, podcast subscribers, and from blog readers. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening during these hot times and caring about our world.
Take a look around. to be a fool.